Hello and welcome to the University of California Press podcast. I'm your host, Chris Gondek. And today I'll be speaking to Agustin Fuentes, the author of Race, Monogamy, and Other Lies They Told You, Busting Myths About Human Nature. Agustin Fuentes is professor of anthropology at the University of Notre Dame. He's the author of Evolution of Human Behavior, Biological Anthropology, Concepts and Connections, and Core Concepts in Biological Anthropology. Agustin Fuentes, thanks so much for taking time to talk to the University of California Press podcast today.
Sure, no problem. My pleasure.
Is there such a thing as human nature?
Well, yes and no. Yes, there's something we can term human nature, but it's not what many people think. It's not a rigid or determined pattern in which we are naturally this or that, naturally aggressive, naturally peaceful. Think of human nature more as outlines and possibilities and the patterns of being human. It's not static or simple. We're really fascinating and complicated species. Human nature is not about sort of just what is natural for humans. Rather, it's about all the possibilities for the human species.
And yet we have so many stories that we tell ourselves about what human nature is. Oh, that person did X because that's just human nature. Is there one place these stories come from, or has it just kind of been, I guess, developed throughout time? We come to see these as, I guess, what we would term common sense, when in fact they're just kind of stories we made up to fill in the blanks.
Right. I mean, they're derived from our experiences and our lives and our bodies. But, culture, common sense, history, a variety of different sort of experiences, reasons, and stories influence the way in which we talk about what we think is normal and natural for humans. I mean, there are many aspects of human beings that are distinctive, compared to other animals, language, symbol, hypersociability, our level of cooperation. But those are sort of broader patterns and processes. Really, human nature is about possibilities, not about sort of single things.
So I want to take a look at two strands that work in your book, because I find that when I talk to people, a lot of people I've talked to, maybe I need to talk to different people, have kind of fuzzy concepts about what they are, and that's myth and evolution. So I'm going to start with the first one, and I would give you kind of, when I would talk to somebody about myth, I would always be concerned that they're going to say, oh, okay, you're just making up a story, and it's not true. But is myth something different than just making up a story that isn't true?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think a myth is just a lie or a story, but really a myth, in the way that I'm using it, are these ways of seeing the world, ways of thinking about things, ways of explaining things. So for us, some myths have a lot of components of truth to them, or at least they pull pieces of reality, but then they get sort of combined with other stories and ideas and experiences. And myths, in the sort of human nature sense, really sort of set the stage for how we interpret the world around us, how we live day to day. You can say they're part of our sort of common sense explanations for why things are the way they are. So it's not that they're lies, but in many cases they're misleading, or they misappropriate different kinds of information and put them together.
And I guess more importantly, you can have two people that have completely different myths about the same occurrence, and ergo where you can run into conflict.
Exactly. So a lot of people explain natural behaviors in very, very different ways. That is, what's natural for one person might not be natural at all for another.
Evolution. A lot of people, and it makes sense, when I would start talking about evolution, I guess immediately, just because there's so much press around biological evolution, that they automatically think, okay, well, you're talking about being descended from apes. You know, but evolution is a system that, true, worked out initially in the biological realm, but it's just not tied to biology. Could you talk a little bit about, I guess, how you're using evolution in this book?
Well, I mean, there's a very simple biological definition of evolution, and that's basically that things, living things, have changed over time. And that's a fact. It's not debatable or disputable. What most people are confused about evolution is the theory of evolution, the idea about the mechanism, how things change over time, right? So evolution is not, it doesn't matter if people believe in it or not, it is, period. But I'm using evolution both in the biological sense, but also in the broader sense of how we think about change over time in societies, in the ways we think, in the ways we see the world. So when I'm talking about biological evolution, I'm specifically talking about the human history of biological change over time. But then it can be used in much broader ways as well. We can think about systems evolving. We can think about patterns evolving, not just sort of the changes in the shape of a bone over time.
All right, let's get in the first one, race. I'm going to start throwing out a couple of racial stereotypes. African-Americans,
okay.
African-Americans are extremely good at sports, Asian-Americans are extremely good at math, and Anglo-Americans kind of fall in the middle. that's a very quick sweep through gross generalizations. Do we know where these come from?
Yeah, we do. We do, actually. Those are myths. they're myths that are set on this mixture of the U.S. history, a mixture of some superficial biological characteristics, and the way in which people sort of experience the world. That division, sort of black, white, Asian, was very different 200 years ago, right? For example, white was not made up of all the folks that are white today. And also the idea of sports being a black thing and sort of SAT scores being an Asian thing, those things have emerged over time as well. Now, there's some patterns. There's some real social patterns there. You see the majority of players in the NBA right now happen to be black. It hasn't always been that way, and it won't always be that way. But these patterns people then try to explain via reference to some kind of biological difference between the races.
So if we were to look at it biologically and look at scientific evidence, you know, we may come up with these stories to explain what we are seeing, I guess, out there with our perception, at least how we're perceiving it. But there's nothing scientifically to back up any of this stuff.
Exactly. So, for example, people said, oh, well, black athletes must have an extra muscle. No. Or there must be something different about black and white athletes. No, there's not difference biologically, but there's social patterns. I mean, there's a strong social structure of assumption about differential abilities in whites and blacks and Asians. And those assumptions can actually shape the way in which we live our lives and see the world around us. And those are the myths that are very dangerous. Because if we assume these social ideologies, which are flexible and change, have an evolutionary or biological basis, then they become dangerous. Because then we just accept them as part of human nature, which in fact they aren't.
I got to say, the whole discussion of NBA and kind of these racial stereotypes makes me think of Jeremy Lin. And wondering at the fact that Jeremy Lin was so successful right off the bat. I mean, and apart from the fact that he's playing in the largest media market in the United States, New York, whether because he was such an outlier and nobody had ever really seen an Asian American play basketball before at that level.
Right, but we have seen Chinese Asians play basketball at that level.
That's true.
You know, there's this whole thing. So it's this weird thing because our expectation, our social expectation, oh, well, you know, Asian guys aren't tall and can't play basketball, when in fact that's not true. There's been a number in the NBA. Or white men can't jump. Well, tell that to all the Italians and Spaniards who are now in the NBA or the whites from the U.S. I think it's because our assumptions are so strong. You're exactly right. So Jeremy Lin shows up and is like, wow, look, an Asian guy is doing well. Not in fact what they should have been saying is, wow, this underrated professional athlete was given a shot, and look at how well he does. So, I mean, part of this is how we start categorizing people. If we start with individual variation and think about people, how they actually vary, and then ask the questions about race and gender and things like that, we're going to get different answers than if we start with race or start with gender.
So, but in the book, you also, I mean, you obviously talk about culture and how important
right.
that is, but you also don't come down to be a total culturalist. I mean, I would think that to the degree that if you were to take here's another gross generalization, but one that was created by a book. Let's take the archetypical Asian dragon mother.
Right.
I'm just whipping them out here right and left from the publishing thing. You know, the question would be if you took anybody, and regardless, you know, black, white, green, and put them in a situation in which that sort of drive toward academic achievement was so strong, you would get somebody who was really strong academically. But I get the point that although that might, there certainly would be strong, I want to say, selection pressures toward that, that it's not necessarily a given that that's what's going to happen.
Exactly. So cultures are highly variable. And this whole idea of stereotyping culture is problematic. So I'm not a pure constructivist. I don't think everything is about culture. Of course, humans vary biologically a lot. And so biological patterns are there. Humans are not all equal. We're not all the same. We vary a lot. We just don't vary in the ways a lot of people think. So culture shapes the way we think about variation, the way we actually exhibit variation. I think it's very important that you can't really pull apart culture and biology and humans. It's like think of the cake analogy, right? We have, you know, butter and sugar and flour and eggs and milk and a cake. But when you bite into the cake, you don't taste any one of those things. They're all melded together to produce a final product. And that's what humanity is. We're not nature or nurture. We're both all the time in every way.
So there isn't really such a thing as race.
Well, let's be really clear.
Is there such a thing as race?
There's a measure for biological race. You can go out and measure what it means to be biological race. There's genetic measurements, there's morphological measurements, and no matter how you do that anywhere on the planet, and they've been doing this for a long time, you find, if you do this scientifically, there's only one human race currently. Now, when the Neanderthals were around, that might have been another human race. I mean, there might have been different biological races, but today there's only one biological race. But that doesn't mean that there aren't social races. We divide people up into social clusters, sometimes using superficial biological characteristics, but they're not really biological. Let me give you an example. So we define black in the United States based on skin color and sort of hair type, curly hair, and sometimes a flatter nose, broad flat nose. Those characteristics, dark skin, broad flat nose, curly hair, show up around the world in different populations, not just in African populations. And in fact, many African populations don't exhibit those patterns. So do you see what I mean? We use these superficial characteristics to make a social race, but it's not a biologically valid category.
Let's move into another area, aggression. Of course, you know, if we go back to the early 20th century and late 19th century when social Darwinism was starting to really kind of become into the superconsciousness, the whole idea about nature being red in tooth and claw and that conflict was a necessary part of, I guess, the progress moving forward was really prevalent. But if you actually look at the record, it's not necessarily conflict and aggression that wins out in the world of evolution.
Yeah, if you look broadly at evolution, you'll see that cooperation is as important as competition. But if you look at humans, over the last couple million years, our ancestors up through modern humans, what we really do well is cooperate. Of course we fight, and we're capable of great violence and aggression. But really, to make things work, to get to the place we've gotten so far, it's all about cooperation. Even the height of what we consider aggression, warfare, could not happen without unbelievably high levels of cooperation to begin with. So I think this over-reliance on aggression as the driving factor in evolution, especially in human evolution, is misplaced. And if you actually look at the fossil record and the archaeological record and what people do 99% of their lives or 99.9% of their lives, you'll see that it's more in cooperation, less in aggression. But that's not to say that aggression isn't important.
You know, the part also for me in this book, I was thinking about other books of evolution I've read, and you do talk about this, that perhaps a myth about evolution is that the evolutionary outcome that happens through natural selection is, by definition, the best outcome that could have happened. And in fact, that's not true either, that you can get suboptimal outcomes in evolution as well.
All the time, people tend to think that, and this is sort of that is an ought fallacy, right? The idea that if something is some way, it's because of evolution, it's perfected it, honed it, and we're evolved, we're at this place. But in fact, evolution itself is pretty sloppy and messy. Look at the world around us. Heck, look at our knees. Our knees are horrible, bad design, right? It's also a good argument against intelligent design, because our knees are not intelligent by any stretch of the imagination. Evolution can produce all sorts of suboptimal results. Evolution is really a story about good enough, not perfect.
So in this book, you hit race, you hit aggression, you hit sex. But what do you want readers to do with the lessons from this book?
Well, I want people to try to critically think. I want people to take this information and challenge the myths that are out there. If they see something in the world and they don't feel right about it, they don't think it's quite right, or they think it's extremely right, well, they should know why, how, where, when, where does the information come from? When people get up on the CNN or Fox or, you know, on some internet sites and make assertions and statements, I want people to be armed with a little bit of information about this, but more importantly, the toolkit for myth-busting themselves. People should make a difference in the world. We have huge brains. They're very complicated, and they work extremely well. People should use them.
Agustin Fuentes, the author of Race, Monogamy, and Other Lies They Told You, Busting Myths About Human Nature. Thanks so much for being on the UC Press podcast today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks.
For more information about this and other titles, please visit our website at www.ucpress.edu. Don't forget you can find the University of California Press on Facebook, www.facebook.com/UC Press. And you can also follow us on Twitter, where we are at UC Press. Thanks for listening to this episode of the University of California Press podcast. Copyright 2012, the University of California Press, all rights reserved.